This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Sarah Dingle. This Monday, the guessing game continues as to when Scott Morrison will call the election. But outside the Canberra bubble, do people really care?
No, not at all. Like, if it wasn't for the fine that was involved in not voting, I probably wouldn't vote at all, to be honest.
Me, myself, personally, I don't really mind when it is, because it doesn't really affect me that much, like, when it is.
And hopes for an electric-powered revival of South Australia's car industry.
I'm absolutely committed to what can be built here. The capability that exists and the capacity that's available in the market. We have all the right ingredients.
Well, a group of vegans has captured the nation's attention today, holding protests against animal cruelty, which have caused chaos for commuters in Melbourne and prompted abattoir arrests in regional New South Wales. The protests mark 1 year since the release of a documentary about the treatment of animals. They also come just after a privacy crackdown on a website which detailed the location and ownership of farms and abattoirs across the country. Connie Aegis reports.
Plant-fueled rage. It was a group of vegans in Melbourne's CBD which led the day of protest against animal cruelty. More than 100 activists, some chaining themselves to vans or sitting on the tram tracks, blocked traffic on the corner of Swanston and Flinders Streets, causing commuter chaos.
I agree with it and I understand where they're coming from, but I think it's really inconsiderate. As I said to one activist, there are people that might have to go to job interviews to support their family, and this has completely ruined any opportunity or chance they have of getting that job. Why do they have to do this at peak hour? Why do they have to do this now?
I'll definitely check it out. It's a bit disruptive to obviously morning commuters who are heading to work.
A group calling itself Vegan Rising organised the protest and it's defending its decision to inconvenience the public. Kristen Lee, campaign director of Vegan Rising, spoke to ABC Radio Melbourne.
Drastic times call for drastic measures. Our planet is dying. Animals are being tortured. This is a climate emergency. This is an animal emergency. And we need people to realise what's going on and to bring their choices into line with their values.
Vegan Rising has a number of demands it wants governments to comply with.
We want transparency, we want the government to start putting health warnings on animal products, we want the government to start showing the truth of what's going on. We've got screens here today showing beautiful babies being tortured so people can drink their mother's milk. We've got plant milks that can completely sustain us, that are more nutritious. And we want the government to start showing what's going on behind these closed doors. We have taken the cameras in there. We have shown the truth and it's all on Dominion and we believe people should watch it. This is a climate emergency as well. We're tearing down forests so that we can grow grain to feed to cows and to other animals when we can just eat the plant foods ourselves and be very healthy. It's all unnecessary. It's all violence. And we don't need to take part in it at all.
It's not the first time the organisation has caused controversy. It's also published a map displaying the locations of farms and abattoirs across Australia. But if the organisation is trying to convince Prime Minister Scott Morrison, it's not working.
Well, I think state and territory governments should ensure that the full force of the law is brought against these green-collared criminals.
The protests also drew a reaction from Federal Coalition MP Michelle Landry in Queensland, who described the action as a disgrace.
You know, one of my daughters is a vegan. She actually gets out there and buys meat and cooks steak for her husband and all the rest of it. That's her decision. But she doesn't push the fact that we shouldn't be eating beef and chickens and fish and all the rest of it down everyone's throats.
There were also protests in Sydney's Hyde Park, as well as regional Victoria and New South Wales. 9 people were arrested after chaining themselves to machinery in a Goulburn abattoir as part of the nationwide protest. Police are monitoring the protests to ensure it remains peaceful.
Connie Aegis. Well, the proposed Adani coal mine is once again causing headaches for the government. There's speculation in one Queensland newspaper today that the election campaign has been delayed while the government waits on final approvals for the mine from Environment Minister Melissa Price. Meanwhile, Queensland Nationals have been out in force this morning, putting the pressure on. They say they want a decision from the minister within days. Here's political reporter Tom Eagledon in Canberra.
It's the question on political lips everywhere. Why did the Prime Minister Scott Morrison not call the election on the weekend? The most credible explanation seems to be that the government can access taxpayer-funded advertising dollars to help sell its budget. But another, more speculative reason has been floated in the Courier Mail, Queensland's biggest newspaper. It has LNP Senator James McGrath calling for Environment Minister Melissa Price to resign if she doesn't approve before the election the Adani coal mine proposed for central Queensland.
It's a report in the Courier Mail. You'll have to ask Senator McGrath. I'm not going to comment on his position on matters.
That's Resources Minister and fellow LNP member Matt Canavan. He says he'll do anything he can to bring mining investment to his home state.
It has to, of course, meet the robust environmental standards that we place on projects in this country. But I also want to, of course, see the jobs be created, the opportunity come to this country, the economic wealth come to our region, central Queensland.
Agriculture Minister David Littleproud says a decision won't be far off.
As I understand, the Adani project's been approved. It's the conditions that are being worked through. And as I understand, Minister Price is working through that with the science from Geoscience Australia and the CSIRO. And I understand a decision will be made very soon.
But the approval of the mine could cause problems for the coalition south of the Queensland border, especially in Victoria, where the coalition's also facing challenges holding on to a handful of seats. Even in the safe seat of Kooyong, the treasurer, Josh Frydenberg's facing two high-profile climate change campaigners. He too was asked about Adani today.
Melissa Price is going through the proper process, working with the scientists, taking the best possible advice.
A similar line emanated from the Prime Minister Scott Morrison when he was questioned on the Adani issue today.
I don't think there is anything particularly unique about these remaining matters. They're quite minor matters in the scheme of the broader approvals that have already been provided. And like in all the other cases, we will be relying on the scientific evidence that is provided to the government in making those decisions.
Tension over Adani's threatening to derail the coalition's attempt to sell its budget and the tax cuts contained within it this week. Scott Morrison's last best chance to wrest an unlikely victory from Labor when the election's called. Two polls out today, News Poll and Ipsos, both have Labor with a commanding lead going into the campaign. 4 points in the case of News Poll, 6 in the case of Ipsos.
We've been the underdog in this campaign right from the outset. And what I know is Bill Shorten's, he's already measured up the curtains. For all I know, he's probably gone out and bought the curtains. But my suggestion is he should keep the receipt.
Deputy Labor Leader Tanya Plibersek spoke with RN's Fran Kelly this morning.
We're not taking anything for granted, Fran. I mean, we're laying out our vision for the future for Australians.
But while the campaign in search of an actual election date continues, spare a thought for the public servants. They've been hauled into Senate estimates this week, unprepared in many cases, given the high expectations that an election was to be called on the weekend. An exchange this morning between Labor Senator Kimberly Kitching and the Clerk of the Senate, Richard Pye, made light of the situation.
This is sort of a surprise week, this week of estimates.
I prefer to think of it as a bonus week, Senator Kitching.
Surprise bonus.
Accountability never sleeps, Senator.
Yes, that's very true.
Labor Senator Kimberly Kitching ending Tom Iggledon's report there. And LNP Senator James McGrath, who was featured in that Courier Mail story, is not returning the ABC's calls today. Well, as we've heard, some pundits thought the election would be called yesterday, but the guessing game continues, with just two possible options in May for a federal poll. But how much do Australians really care about when the election falls? Sarah White took to the streets to ask.
Scott Morrison often talks about the Canberra bubble. He's referring to what matters to politicians, the press, and anyone who has a connection with Parliament House. The current obsession within that bubble is when the federal election could be called. But outside the bubble, such as here in the inner city of Sydney, the timing of the election is not on everyone's radar.
Sam, you're on your way to uni. Do you care when the federal election is going to be called?
No, not really. Like, I'm only just been put into the electoral form, I guess. So I'm, you know, sort of starting to develop my knowledge on it and don't really have an opinion on it just yet. But so, yeah. Not really.
This is your first time voting in a federal election?
Yeah, I only just voted in the state election recently, and it will be my first time voting in the federal election too. Yeah.
But the timing of it doesn't really matter to you?
No, not at all. Like, if it wasn't for the fine that was involved in not voting, I probably wouldn't vote at all, to be honest.
Matthew, do you care when the election is called?
I mean, not particularly, no, but I see why it affects other people in their jobs and how it can mess that up. But me, myself, not really, no.
Is this your first federal election?
Yes, it is.
And do you know how you're going to vote?
Not sure yet, no.
Clarice, you're on your way to a TAFE class. Do you care when the election is called?
Yes, I do.
Why is that?
Because it's like controlling Australia. Like, it controls everything that we do, the system and everything. So, yeah, I do care.
Someone who's closely watching is ABC's election analyst Anthony Green.
There's only a limited number of dates left, and it just seems a bit silly to be playing around with these games.
Why do you think there are these games around announcing when the election will be?
The date of the election, the day you announce the election, doesn't have much impact. The only thing that announcing the date of the election does, very rare for us to get this close. The last times, said 1974, and before that you've got to go back to 1954 to find the last time there was a May election. It's very rare for us to get this close to the end of a term.
Why do you think that's happening?
Well, this is happening because the last election was a double dissolution, which reset the election dates. Normally, elections these in recent decades have tended to be at the end of the financial year, at the end of the annual year. So in the last 3 months, October, November, December, that's the normal time for Australian elections. And then that's 6 months before the end of the Senate terms. But because the last election was held in July and it was a double dissolution, then there had to be another Senate election by May this year.
When you talk about issuing writs to people who don't really understand how an election works, what does that mean?
A writ is a formal document from the monarch instructing an official to engage in a certain act. That's what the definition of a writ is. It's unusual. They're done by courts. They're done by the Crown. They're sort of an old-fashioned style of way of instructing something happen. And so what's happened is a writ is issued, which goes to the electoral commissioner and the returning officers, saying conduct an election on this date, close the rolls on this date, close the nominations on such and such a date, and then return the writ afterwards, the name of the elected members. That's all the writ is.
But there's a constitutional quirk. If Scott Morrison doesn't call the election this week, Anthony Green says some states could break rank and announce when they will issue half Senate writs. In other words, trumping Scott Morrison's announcement of the date.
You know, if the government hasn't done anything by the end of this week and is still playing around with games and dates, you might find one of the Labor state governments might sort of enter the fray by saying something on the subject. But look, if it's the 18th of May, look, the writs may be issued. The date is announced always before the writs are issued, because they have to give the state governors the time to get the writ signed. So it's normally done on a Friday or a Saturday or a Sunday, and then the writs are issued on the Monday. They might bring the writs forward this time just to avoid Anzac Day, because they've issued the writ on the Monday. Anzac Day would be the date for the close of nominations, and that would be a public holiday and cause a few delay problems.
Scott Morrison might be keeping us waiting, but come election night, it's unlikely Anthony Green will when it comes to calling the winner.
Sarah White reporting. Well, whenever the trigger is pulled on a federal election, there's no prizes for guessing that economic management will be front and centre. And economists are focusing on how the two major parties will confront the big challenges, like the housing correction, weak wages growth, and a slowing global economy. Here's the ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan.
Whether it's forecasting a budget surplus, trying to eliminate debt, somehow stoking wages growth, dealing with a housing correction, or tax handouts to jargon-weary voters, both major parties are in a race for economic credibility. But get behind the pre-election spin, and economists will tell you the sell is not that easy.
Well, there are a number of challenges. One is that we've got a cooling housing market. House prices are falling in our major cities, and that's starting to weigh on the consumer to a degree. And that's one of the challenges we face in terms of the growth story for Australia.
Paul Bloxham is chief economist at HSBC Australia and New Zealand and a one-time Reserve Bank economist. Not surprisingly, he sees the fallout from the real estate slump as the number one headwind for any new government and something that might get in the way of a wages recovery.
Both parties are obviously proposing to deliver tax cuts and support the household sector, so that should provide some support for the household sector in the face of that cooling housing market, but that's certainly a challenge that they'll face nonetheless.
And those concerns about the housing correction were pretty prominent in the budget papers.
That's right. So the budget assumes that the cooling housing market does weigh on the consumer, and the offset in the budget is firstly the tax cuts which are proposed, obviously, And then also the fact that there's an assumption that wages growth will pick up pace and quite in a quite a decent way in the budget papers. Now, that's a working assumption, but that's something we've got to see happen. Otherwise, growth might be a bit slower than is actually assumed in those numbers. So getting wages growth to pick up is another feature of what we're likely to see as a policy challenge.
And those projections on wages were pretty optimistic, looking at 3.5% eventually, but the wage price index is stuck at 2.3%.
Well, that's right. So they are quite optimistic wage price assumptions.
Sarah Hunter, chief economist at BIS Oxford Economics, says the challenge of breathing life into wages, if not met, could put pressure on the $7.1 billion surplus forecast for next financial year.
It's really a case for both sides of being able to pitch that they will be able to keep the economy growing, that what they put on the table will be able to offset at least partially the housing market downturn that we're going through. And that's what's really vital in terms of keeping employment growth going and wage growth accelerating.
And the other big issue that the ratings agencies have noted is also wages or slow wages growth, but also the projection for a recovery and wages are holding up. How firm is that looking to you?
I'd say that's another area in their projections that are certainly looking somewhat rosy, given the way wages growth has played out over the last year or so. And again, that makes it challenging for them to potentially hit that projected surplus that they've got for FY20.
Given the headwinds, both the Coalition and Labor are managing expectations. But Sarah Hunter says the better-than-expected prices for coal and iron ore, which underpin the budget, look like continuing.
So the government have actually been quite conservative, I would say, in terms of their commodity price projections for the near term. They expect them to come back quite a bit. I'm actually a bit more optimistic. I think they'll hold up better, particularly iron ore, because we know there's a lot of supply disruption in that market that's not at all related to Australia. It's related to some events in Brazil. But that's good news for our iron ore producers because they get to benefit from those higher prices, and iron ore is by far and away the most important commodity for us.
But in the end, it's a game of economic chance. With headwinds like Brexit, US-China trade tensions, and a slowing global economy, key challenges out of any government's control.
The ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. This is The World Today. Israel's Prime Minister has suggested he'll extend sovereignty to illegal Jewish settlements in the West Bank right on the eve of an election. Benjamin Netanyahu is fighting for his political life and possibly to stay out of jail as he seeks a fifth term in office when polls open tomorrow. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek reports.
For years, Benjamin Netanyahu has walked a line between placating the international community and keeping right-wing Jewish settlers who live in the occupied West Bank on his side. But when asked why his government had not annexed major Jewish settlements in Palestinian territory, he made his intentions clear. Who says we won't do that, he says. We're on the way. The next term will be fateful. We'll go to the next stage. The Palestinian delegation's chief negotiator, Saeb Erekat, responded more with resignation than surprise in a written statement. Israel will continue to brazenly violate international law, he says, for as long as the international community will continue to reward Israel with impunity. Mr. Netanyahu's statements, this late in the election campaign, were a clear appeal to right-wing voters who he desperately needs to support his Likud party in order to stay in power. The stakes could not be higher for the Prime Minister. After resisting an early election, Benjamin Netanyahu changed his mind when it looked like Israel's Attorney General was preparing to indict him on corruption charges. He wants to fight those charges, which he's derided as attempts by the leftist media and legal establishment to remove him with the protection and influence of high office. Now he's making last-minute appeals to voters. The media and the lefties want you to stay at home, he says. They don't want you to use your votes and your power. They want to put you to sleep. Go and vote and we can show the media that we can defeat the other side. Benjamin Netanyahu has reason to be worried. Several polls are predicting a narrow win for his main opponents, the Blue and White Coalition led by former Israel Defense Force Chief of Staff Benny Gantz. While Lieutenant General Gantz is being portrayed by Mr. Netanyahu as a left-wing peacenik, he campaigned heavily on his military record, including promoting the number of supposed terrorists he killed in Gaza.
I am a soldier. That is who I am.
That is what I do. I fought in battles you've heard of and in operations you will never win.
Standing with Mr. Gantz is Benjamin Netanyahu's former defence minister, Moshe Yaalon, and another former chief of staff, Gabi Ashkenazi. It's the first time in years that Benjamin Netanyahu's supremacy in the field of defence and security is being seriously challenged. So a tough battle looms at the ballot box before Benjamin Netanyahu has to fight one in court. From Jerusalem, this is Eric Dvorak reporting for The World Today.
Domestic sales of electric vehicles are some of the lowest in the developed world, but a future of electric cars could be closer than we think. A new report by the International Council for Clean Technology finds that in the US market, electric vehicles will cost the same as conventional cars as soon as 2025. And in Australia, the NRMA is sniffing the wind and building a national network of electric charging stations. Caroline Winter reports.
Hi, Paul.
Paul
Kosh has been an electric car convert since 2011.
And that's it, we're ready to go.
Ready to go, yeah. Get around the block.
So this is your first bought all-electric car.
Yeah, because we had a conversion beforehand because we wanted to get an EV and you couldn't buy one 8 years ago, so we decided to do a conversion.
And how different is this to what you had?
Luxury. Absolute luxury.
As we drive through Adelaide's CBD to a charging station, Paul Kosh tells me how his concern for the environment prompted him to go electric. He heads the South Australian branch of the Australian Electric Vehicle Association, which has lobbied governments for 40 years on electric vehicles. And he's chuffed with Federal Labor's announced target of half of all new car sales to be electric by 2030.
There's no real incentive for the manufacturers to bring in a lot of vehicles because we haven't got targets in Australia.
But can South Australia be more than an importer of electric vehicles? Yes, definitely, according to those already in the industry.
If you're going to be a net consumer of technology, it's good to be a part of that evolving technology and play a role in it for the benefit of both, let's say, the state and the country.
Christian Reynolds is Director of Precision Buses in Adelaide. His resume includes the likes of MG Rover, Lotus, component supplier ZF Lemforder and Tesla. Like many, he's part of Adelaide's rich car-making history, which was once home to Mitsubishi and GM Holden, which closed 18 months ago, marking an end to traditional car manufacturing in Australia. But the technical expertise remains, with engineers, designers and those in the component supply chain, like Christian Reynolds, finding their drive in a new market.
The capability that exists and the capacity that's available in the market, we have all the right ingredients.
He's part of a joint venture which is building two electric buses for the South Australian government. They'll be the first to be fully designed, engineered and built in Australia to be used in a public transport system. Christian Reynolds says good policy and collaboration will be key to the state and the country's success in the electric space.
It's really a case of the leadership position, the flagship projects that people can kind of support and come on board with. And if we can collaborate as businesses, we'll stand a very good chance of building something quite significant.
The dramatic change in the auto landscape is ripe for entrepreneurs. Joran Roos, visiting professor at the Industrial Transformation Centre at Flinders University, says there are opportunities to be had, but warns the complexities of the disrupted market shouldn't be underestimated.
It used to be that if you went down a global value chain from the guy who made the car all the way down, you occasionally found more than one supplier of rearview mirrors or whatever it is. There's got to be a much tighter global value chain. In other words, the supply chain will be made up of one company rather than maybe three on a given level. And that again makes it quite important that you are able to break in early in these global value chains.
And Joran Roos says the electric car market may not be the obvious choice for Australia, but instead producing electric options for the commercial sector, like mining, long-haul transport and ferries.
It does require us to think through very, very clearly where we already have revealed comparative advantages. In other words, where are we better than we ought to be given our size? And then build on those and do it in a way that is supported by a demanding local market that gives us the scale and the demands to fulfill that then enable us to move out and export these things successfully.
Automotive expert Joran Roos, a visiting professor at Flinders University. Caroline Winter reporting there. And that's all from the World Today team for this Monday. Linda Mottram and the PN team will be along this evening. We'll be back same time tomorrow with more stories from across Australia and around the world. I'm Sarah Dingle. Have a great day.
Hi, I'm Angela Voipierre.
And I'm Stephen Smiley, and we're from The Signal. It's the ABC's daily news and current affairs podcast.
And on today's episode, we're talking about psychedelics, which researchers reckon are chronically misunderstood.
Right, so what do we know about drugs like acid and ayahuasca, and could something like them one day be prescribed to treat anxiety and depression?
That's The Signal. It's available to play right now in the ABC Listen app or wherever else you're playing this.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.